All right, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Wrestling with Faith. This is our fifth session, and our focus today is science and faith, science and religion, specifically in our context. This is the InTown Jewish Academy, after all, so we're going to focus on science and the Jewish faith, Judaism. They tell a story that God was feeling very happy after he had begun creating, and he felt very, very accomplished. So God gathers the angels together, and he says, "Hey angels," that's, I guess, what you say. He says, "Hey angels, hey y'all, you'll never guess what I did. I just created this incredible segment of 24 hours with alternating day and night sessions. It's so cool. I am so excited about this. It's great. It's so good." And the angels say to God, "So what are you going to do now?" God says, "I think I'm just going to call it a day." Ooh.
Where do you get these?
Terrible, right? You heard about the first wedding on Pluto? The band was amazing, but there was no atmosphere. Okay, science. Science and faith is our topic today. So let's jump right in. Okay, this course, of course, is Wrestling with Faith, and the theme of this course is addressing those issues and questions that might come up in the context of our faith. So, you know, challenges to our faith, things that come up. We talked about when bad things happen to good people that can challenge our faith. We spoke about, you know, trying to wrap our minds around the concept of a God that we can't see, touch, or feel. So, there are things that kind of That might challenge our faith. And one major area that I think exists that can challenge our faith is science. Science is great, but sometimes science can lead a person or turn a person away from faith. And I'll tell you what I mean. We all know some major, like very famous scientists, even one who recently passed away, who were very much avowed atheists. And they use their scientific knowledge and experience to say, "Look, we are people of science. We know how things work. We don't need God." Famously, Crick, you know, one of the DNA, Watson and Crick? Not Watson and Holmes. You know the one where Sherlock Holmes and Watson are they're camping? And Watson says to Holmes, "Look up, what do you see?" He says, Watson says, "I see the stars, I see the sky." He says, "What do you see?" "I see somebody stole our tent." So, there's different things that you can see. Science, though, when you study science, it could potentially pull someone away from faith in something higher than science. In other words, it almost seems like the world of science and the world of faith, the world of science and the world of religion, the world of science and Judaism, perhaps exist in different universes, exist in different, totally different planes of reality, and may be contradictory and non-complementary to each other. So today's class, which is a very ambitious class, the goal of today's class is to take the world of science and the world of religion, the world of science and the world of faith, the world of science and the world of Judaism, and merge them together, to show that they're not only are they not contradictory, but actually they in fact complement each other. So let's begin. We have a lot of really, really cool things to cover. Let's jump right in. I want to begin by you telling me what areas of conflict you think might exist between science and religion or faith or Judaism. So work with your table mates or whatever, groups of two and three, and discuss. I'll give you 90 seconds, 120 seconds, 2 minutes, a minute and a half to discuss what are some areas of conflict between science and faith. Please begin. Talk amongst yourselves. Stanley, you got to get in on the action here. I know you to be a man of science.
Yeah.
All right, 60 seconds. Conflicts between science and faith, science and religion, science and Judaism. What are your conflicts? Not yet. Soon. Soon. You have the same conflicts? You got some good stuff? All right, hold on. We'll discuss it together. This is such a good topic. I love this discussion. 20 seconds. Clock is ticking, but who's counting anyway? I am.
I told somebody the joke about the latke with the candle.
Yeah, with the oil. Yeah.
He just cracked it.
It's so true, though. It is totally true. Oh, man. I think next week for the classes on Hanukkah, I think we'll have some Hanukkah-themed food. We'll have some. Maybe we'll cut down on the oil, but you're supposed to have oil. All right, folks, let's pick it up together. So, okay, let's all bring it in. The question, of course, on the table is, what areas of conflict do you find or do you feel exist between science and faith?
I was mentioning these genetically modified babies that
yes.
were born just in the last few days.
Yes, designer babies.
Right, and I'm not sure that I'm at all comfortable with that.
Right, so that might be an area where science is getting ahead of our beliefs or ethics, etc. Good. What else? Areas of conflict that we... Yeah.
Creation and evolution.
Right. How did it happen? Did God create the world, or did it evolve?
Well, and the question of 7 days, or like in your advertising, 5,700 years.
Yeah, what's up with the age of the universe? Is it really 5,779 years old, or is it...
Maybe older.
Or is it billions of years old, right?
Right.
How do we reconcile these distinctions? What else? Do you guys have that? Age of the universe? Yeah, that's
age of the world.
That's a classic, yeah. Age of the universe. Okay, what else? Anything? Yeah.
We talked about the hugeness of the issues that are involved with science and those people who take scriptures literally.
Mm.
And one we didn't talk about, which both the Jewish and the Catholic faith, the faiths are very hard on scientists.
Right.
People were hard on Galileo. People
yes.
were hard on Spinoza. And faiths are very difficult with scientists. So there may be something there that we're worried about.
So it seems like sometimes people that speak on behalf of religion or faith seem to be skeptical of science. Scientists... oftentimes might be skeptical of people of faith. So there seems to be a vast divide, and I want to speak about this on two different levels, and here's how I will articulate it. There's the methodology question, and then there's the facts on the ground question, and I'll explain. The methodology of science and scientific inquiry and the scientific method and process is very different than methodology of faith. Okay. So if you are in the market to buy a car, what are you typically doing before you spend a lot of money on a vehicle? What are you typically doing?
Research.
Where are you researching? Give me some examples.
CarMax,
Consumer Reports. What? Where else? I mean, that's fine. We don't have to get more.
a lot of websites that tell you how to...
Yeah, how to negotiate, how much you should pay, how much it's worth, if you're buying a used car, whatever, all that stuff. Wonderful. We might call this part an example of the scientific method. Now, it's not like you're doing a laboratory experiment, but you are analyzing, you are researching, you are, in a sense, testing. You do a test drive, right? And then you arrive at your conclusion of what you want to buy and how much you want to pay for it, and then you make the purchase if all goes well. Or you just get... tossed around from person to person for a full day, and then you're like, I can't think anymore, I need to go home. Either way, it happens, and not all science works out either. So that's the scientific method. Take a look at exercise number one, page 142. This will give us kind of a sense of some of the contrast. We'll do this together. So which of the following choices did you make after extensive research and carefully considering your various options? Choice of career. Do we research our career typically? Of course. Choice of spouse. Yes, should have researched. Okay, but at some level of research, choice of a home.
Definitely that.
All right. Choice of a home always gets the biggest yes because we bring in inspectors and we have title searches and all that stuff. We don't just bet on a home. We do our research there. Choice of school for our children.
If you have the means.
Right. Okay.
Depends
where you live. Okay. On some level. What about your choice of religion?
Pretty much born with that.
Right. So for most people, now that obviously. This is not true for everyone. And there's a lot of religious inquiry and study and analysis that also takes place in the realm of religion. But for the most part, I think many people, or a lot of people, just stick with what they got. They stick with the religion that they grow up with. And faith is not something that they necessarily put under a microscope. Faith is seen to be something that you just accept or believe in. And thus, it becomes a little bit challenging for the modern mind because we live in a world today, we live in an era at a time when we are trained to critically think about things and not accept things blindly. We think, we analyze, we use our logic and rationale, and we try to cut to the truth of that which is in front of us. But religion and faith, for the most part, almost demands from us some sort of blind acceptance. Or at least that's the way it's understood or seen to be. Blind acceptance. So the methodology of science and faith is very different. The methodology of science is research, analysis, comparison, that sort of thing. Faith, acceptance, belief, right? Blind. Faith is blind. Or is that what they say about love? Maybe it's the same thing. You ever wonder why they say falling in love? No one ever walked gently into love. It's always falling into love. Something to think about. Okay, so that's with regards to methodology. The methodologies are different. By the way, I should mention that, of course, as with anything that we can discuss, there are ways to look at it on the other side. In other words, you can say that science also has elements of faith and belief, where scientists have to, they have to make hypotheses and they have to make assumptions and then they try to prove it to be correct or try to experiment and demonstrate that it works. So there's a sense of a faith there as well.
It's a theory,
it's not a fact, right? Science, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the lesson. With religion and faith, there are things that we can critically think about and understand. So you have a little bit in both, but primarily science is about logic, and faith is about suspension of logic and acceptance, typically. Okay, so here we have a diversion of methodologies. Let's talk about facts on the ground. Facts on the ground means, like, what does each system say? So let's use the examples that we had before. Science says the world is a number of billions of years old. I don't know what the latest number is, but it's getting older every single day. At least by a day. You know the guy who walks into the museum and he asks the person that's working there, how old are these dinosaur bones? And he says, 4 billion years and a week. He says, wow, that's very precise. How do you know it's exactly 4 billion in a week? He says, well, because when I started working here a week ago, they said it was 4 billion years old. So I figure it's 4 billion in a week. That's just the way it works. Anyway, so science says the world is billions of years old. And Torah says 5,779 years old. And that's it. There's a bit of a difference. There's a few years of a difference. It's not like science is like, no, we think it's more like 6,500 years old. So we're up by 5. No. It's like billions versus a few thousand. That's a big gulf. And then we had the other issue that came up before, which is creation versus evolution. Torah speaks about God making things. God made heaven and earth. He made the sun, moon, and stars. He made this, he made that. He made plants and trees and people and animals and all that. Okay, finished products. And science says evolution. So the young girl goes over to her mother, and she says, where do we come from? So the mother says, well, God created human beings. She says, well, that's not what Dad said. Dad said we come from the apes. So the mom says, not a contradiction. He's speaking about his side of the family. I'm speaking about my side of the family. It's not at all a contradiction. And with that, I must go. No, I'm kidding. I'm just going to close. So, okay. So these are some of the big questions about facts on the ground. So there's methodology, which is, can the modern mind that's trained in the ways of science, can the modern mind get behind faith and suspension of rationale? And how do we reconcile some hard numbers that are way divergent? 6,000 years versus 6 billion years or 16 billion years. How do we deal with that? Evolution versus creation. So throughout the class, I'm going to present some big ideas. There are going to be four major ideas, and we'll go through them one at a time. And each is going to present another area of this discussion. So here's big idea number one. Big idea number one is that although science and faith, science and religion, or science and Torah, seem to be on completely different pages, completely different, existing in completely different realities, nonetheless, big idea number one is Torah requires science. You cannot have Torah without science, and I'll explain what I mean. And conversely, science, as told by a rabbi, requires Torah. You heard it here first, and I'll explain that as well. Let's begin. Torah requires science. Many areas of Jewish law, in order to properly either decide the ruling of a case or whatever it is, or figure out the way that the law should proceed, requires a strong knowledge of the sciences. To illustrate this, let's do a fun exercise. Exercise 2A, 2B, and 2C. Let's start on page 144. We're going to do this together. Okay, exercise 2A. So put this aside for a second and just focus on the exercise. List three types of injuries that are survivable and three types of injuries that are fatal. Survivable injuries. Car accident. Well, depends what kind. Okay, yeah.
Break a leg.
I feel like I'm on stage. Thank you for the good wishes. Break a leg.
No, real broken.
See that? Yeah. What else? Survival.
Conk on the head,
right?
A burn.
No one said paper cut? Oh, I just did. Okay, fatal. Fatal. What are fatal injuries?
A conk on the head,
heart attack.
Suicide.
Okay. And then look at the bottom question. Please indicate which field of science you drew on to answer this question. Medicine, biology. Good. Exercise 2B, page 145. Let's move right on. Exercise 2B, page 145. Under what conditions does metal expand, and under what conditions does it contract?
When it heats up,
it does what?
Expands.
And when it cools down, contracts. You guys remember the Challenger?
Yeah.
The space shuttle? I watched that live. That was really traumatic. I was a kid, and that was, what was it, 86?
Yeah.
I was 7? Whatever. So, like, I'm thinking, that's not supposed to happen. This is not supposed to happen, disintegrating in the sky. But remember what it came down to? O-rings. What happened? It was cold, and they didn't test it, it shrunk, or it was brittle, it broke, whatever it is. But this notion of heat or cold expanding or contracting, it plays an important role. Please indicate which field of science you drew on to answer this question.
Physics,
maybe chemistry. Okay. Exercise 2C, turn the page, please, to 146. Oh, now it's getting serious. Now you gotta access all those I don't know.
Formulas
that you learned way back when. If you draw a circle around a 30-inch diameter, How large will the circumference be? You don't have to use a calculator. Let's just discuss it for a moment. Let me explain what's going on here. If you draw a circle, 30-inch diameter means from one end of the circle to the other. So if it's 30, right, 30 inches, how long around is it? 30 times pi. How much is pi?
3.14.
And it keeps on going, right? 3.14, etc., etc. I have nieces and nephews that know like 100 or 200 digit spaces of pi. Just in case it ever comes down to it, you never know. It's like, wait a second, tell me what's after 0.14. Like, I got this. All right. Good. Which field of science did you draw on to answer that question?
Mathematics.
Good. Now, did you know that all three questions are not just scientific questions, but they relate to Jewish law very closely? In fact, to accurately practice Jewish law, you have to have a knowledge of the areas of biology and medicine, chemistry and physics, and mathematics. And if you don't know that, then you won't be able to properly practice Jewish law. And I'll explain. In Jewish law, kind of right, should have been paying more attention. Okay. Here's how it works. In Jewish law, for something for an animal to be kosher, so the type of animal that it can be, the species of animal, has to be a land animal that chews its cud and has split hooves. Okay. In addition to that, it has to be shechted properly. What is shechted? It has to be slaughtered in a very humane way with a super sharp knife that has no nicks in it, etc. Okay. But after that, even if it's a kosher animal, and it was slaughtered in a proper humane way, kosher way, even still, it might not be kosher. There's one more piece to this. Well, yeah, the blood has to be removed from the meat. Yes, good. But even before that, it has to be, who said that? Has to be healthy. It has to be salted to take out the blood, right? But before that, you have to do somewhat of an autopsy on the animal to make sure that the animal was healthy. If the animal has some sort of mortal wound or fatal wound, even though it was still alive, but it had a wound, it had an injury that would have caused it to die an unnatural death at some point soon, you cannot eat the animal. It's not a healthy animal. It's not kosher. No, because you can't check the lungs for a puncture. I mean, maybe you can if you stick a thing in. I don't know. But the way they... My grandfather, in addition to being a scribe, also back in the day was a shochet. Well, yeah, he shechted, but he... Actually, in the plants, he mainly... He checked the lungs. That was his specialty. So he would... Yeah, he would check... He would check check the lungs and make sure that the lungs... If there was any hole in the lungs, the animals... You can't eat the animal. It's not kosher. What did they do if it was not kosher? They would sell it to the other part of the plant, which sold it as non-kosher meat. But that's the way it is. Treif meat. But kosher meat, not only is the right type of animal, slaughtered the right way, and the blood is extracted, not only that, but it's actually healthy. The animal has to be ascertained healthy. So now you have a scientific and biological medical question. The animal, you notice, now has a wound or has some sort of injury. Is it an injury that's survivable or a fatal injury? So if you are putting the stamp of kosher on meat, you have to have a knowledge of what?
Medicine.
Of animal biology and medicine on some level. You don't have to be like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like who's a famous vet. Famous show of a vet. What was her name? Wasn't there, huh? What is this? James Harriet. Who's James Harriet?
From England.
Oh, okay.
Preacher's great at song.
Yeah. There you go. Was she a vet? Was she a vet? My bad. So you don't need to be on that level, but you have to have a knowledge of some sort of a... So that's one example. In 2B, we talked about metal expanding and contracting. Well, this is also relevant to the laws of kosher. You know, if you have a food that's unkosher, you have unkosher food. We would call loosely treif, but treif really refers to animals and not what. But let's say you have a piece of food that's not kosher, and it touches a metal utensil. Does the metal utensil become unkosherized, or does it remain kosher?
Kosher.
Depends.
Is it cold?
If it's hot, it becomes unkosher. If it's cold, you can have some non-kosher food fraternizing with something metal utensil for months on end. If it's cold, you rinse it off, you're good. If it's hot, even for a moment, it's not kosher. And then you have to kosher it by heating it up again. Why? What does heat do? Heat expands. And the concern here is that when it expands, some flavor from that non-kosher food item is being absorbed into, on a molecular level, into the metal utensil. No, this is straight up. This is Jewish law, right? So it goes into the metal, and then now there's actual absorption in the walls, let's say, of a pot. In the walls of your metal pot has the absorption of that food. And then when you cook again the next time, the metal expands, and some of that absorption flavor is going to go out into the new food that you're cooking and make that food not kosher. So you got to kosher it, and there's certain ways to kosher it. That's why I have my blowtorch. I'm kidding. I don't have a blowtorch right here, but that's one way to do it. Use a blowtorch, get it white hot.
Is that a new law?
No. We knew this.
How?
I can't tell you how. That's part of the whole thing. No, I'm kidding. No, but Jewish law talks about this 100%. This is straight up Jewish law. Now, look at exercise 2C, the last one we had, which about a circle around the circumference of a circle. Why is this relevant? If you want to build a sukkah in a circle, a round sukkah, you've seen square sukkahs, right? You've seen a sukkah like those huts, right? Those huts that have four walls, right? Maybe three walls. Sometimes you leave out a wall just, you know, for fun. But you can actually build a kosher sukkah in a circle. Okay? The minimum size of a circle, sorry, that makes no sense. The minimum size of a sukkah is 21 inches by around approximately 21 inches by 21 inches square. Now, you might think that's really small, and you would be right, but it's enough to put your head inside and eat something inside that sukkah if it was 21 by 21, okay? But let's say you want to build a round sukkah that has that area of 21 by 21 inside. So think about it for a second. So your circle has to completely encircle this 21 by 21 square, which means that the diameter of the circle has to be equivalent to what we would call in Jewish terminology, the alachsoin, or the diagonal of the triangle. So if you have 21 and it's a right angle triangle, right? 21 by 21, what's my diagonal? What's the hypotenuse? The hypotenuse. What's the hypotenuse? A squared plus B squared equals C squared. You didn't think at all you were going to walk into this today, did you? This is happening live on the Beltline. We go Beltline, we go mathematic crazy. So A squared plus B squared equals C squared. Do the math, run the numbers. Boom, it's about 30. 29.6. So it's about 30 is your hypotenuse, which means your diameter, let's say, is around 30. So what's your circumference? I need to buy materials to make my round sukkah, the minimum size, to put my head in. So I 21 by 21, diagonal is about 29.6. My circumference is, we said before, 30 times 3.14. It's approximately 90-something inches. It's the approximate. 90 plus, a little bit over 90 inches. So, if you want to build a sukkah and know the minimum kosher size of a sukkah, you have to have an awareness of which field of science?
Geometry
and mathematics. You can't get away in halacha and Jewish law without knowing the sciences, let alone if you want to know about the Jewish calendar. If you want to make a Jewish calendar, be proficient in the Jewish calendar, you know what you have to have an understanding of? Astronomy, straight up astronomy. Take a look at page 147, figure 5.1. These are some areas of science that Torah requires as a knowledge base to accurately understand Jewish law. Medicine, zoology, botany, biology, algebra, geometry, mathematics, astronomy, linguistics, music, chemistry, just to name a few. So the point is like this. Torah, you cannot isolate Torah and science. You cannot say that, well, Judaism and Torah, it's a matter of faith. And it's not a matter of science. You don't need to study science. You don't need to know science. It's a totally different realm. You can just have faith in God and do your thing and not need science. You can't. You can't. Any kosher item that you buy from a store that's mass-produced, that has a kosher symbol on it, somebody certified that plant, I don't mean like a plant that grows, that manufacturing plant to be kosher, or this line to be kosher. That person or that certifying agency has a vast knowledge of scientific areas of production, mass production, and engineering, and chemical chemistry, because of the chemical products inside food sometimes, etc. So you food engineering, all of that stuff. You have, in order to accurately practice, teach, observe, etc., Jewish law, Zugesund, you must have a knowledge of the sciences. So thus, big idea number one, bless you, is Torah needs science. Does this make sense? Yes? Makes sense? Okay. Now, let's look at the But you can't. You can't because you don't know the facts on the ground. Torah law says that if this is true, do this. If that's true, do that. You can't know if this is true or that's true without knowing the science. Not every area do you need to know science. Right? Not every area. Right? But many areas that come up. I'll give you a very practical application of this. The laws of Jewish law says that if somebody is in critical danger, you break Shabbat, you violate Shabbat, and you get the medical attention. If they have a cold, it's not a big deal. But you know, there's a big gap between a cold, the common cold, and something that is life-threatening. And so the question is, what do you do in a case where you're not sure if this is dangerous or not dangerous? So maybe you consult with a rabbi. Well, how does a rabbi know? You would hope that the rabbi has some sort of medical understanding, or you would hope that the rabbi would also be able to consult with a doctor, somebody that can actually analyze it. So you can't ascertain. If Jewish law says that if it's life-threatening injury, break Shabbat, how do you know if it is if you have no awareness of medicine? So what I'm saying is Torah law requires a certain measure of scientific knowledge.
I think the best that you would do, the best decision you would make would be acceptable and still follow Judaism. If you didn't have a doctor that, you know, a rabbi.
If you didn't, but
you'd make the best decision possible, I think that would be 100%.
Yeah, it's always good to make the best. It's always good to do your best. But that's not, the question here is not about doing your best. The question is, what does Jewish law say in this scenario? Do you go to the hospital or you don't go to the hospital? And so that's a medical question. It's not a halakha question. Jewish law says that if it's life-threatening, do it. Jewish law doesn't tell you what's life-threatening. That's what medicine tells you. But Jewish law says, so ask a doctor. So you need science. You can't accurately follow halacha without scientific knowledge. It doesn't mean that every rabbi has to be an expert in all the fields. But a rabbi has to have, to accurately talk about Jewish law, has to have access to those individuals, at least those individuals that have a proficiency in those areas.
The Talmudic
scholars had a vast knowledge of the fields of astronomy and medicine, and look at Maimonides, right? Maimonides, an astronomer, physician, philosopher. He was proficient in philosophy. He had a well-rounded knowledge. So the point is like this: that Jewish law, and we actually have it's along what we're getting through here. We have a video, a 5-minute video that I'll show after the class about modern questions in halacha. If you've ever used the Shabbat elevator, if you've ever heard of the concept of a Shabbat elevator, it's not for. We'll talk about it after the class, but you have to have a knowledge of science and engineering in order to create a Jewishly kosher Shabbat elevator.
Wheelchair.
Yeah, there's. I mean, you have to have. There are whole. What's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, there are academies in Israel that are all about technology and halacha and Jewish law. You can't, there's certain areas of Jewish law that you just can't accurately talk. I mean, you can make up stuff and say, well, this, based on what I know, I think. But that's not, if halacha is about precision, like what's the, you have to have a knowledge of the facts on the ground, and that requires a knowledge of the science. So the point is that Judaism does not look at science as something outside or something isolated or something, you know, that's not necessary. In fact, many areas are very necessary to the everyday practice of Jewish law. Conversely, I would argue that science, even if it doesn't realize it, science needs Torah, and here's why. Science talks does a really good job talking about the hows and the whats, or the whats and the hows. Science will tell you, you know, what happens and why it what happens and how it happens and, you know, how the mechanics work. But one thing that science does not talk about, and in a sense almost cannot talk about, is the why, the ultimate why. Now, why? Forget about the ultimate why of, like, why are we all here? But any real why you can only answer outside the system that you're studying. There's a beautiful text number 2, Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Sacks, where he explores this concept of science versus faith. Page 149. Tom, please get us started.
Take a game like football with the Falcons.
Oh, he actually means he's English. He means soccer. He means, I know, I'm sorry. Yeah. Oh, Atlanta United. Tonight, right?
7 o'clock.
Tonight, yeah, huge game. All right, he means football or soccer.
Take a game like anything. Some hypothetical visitor from a land to which soccer has not yet penetrated wants to understand this strange ritual which excites so much passion. You explain the rules of the game, what counts as a foul, what constitutes a goal, and so on. Fine, says the visitor. I now understand the game. What I don't understand is why you get so excited about it. Here you might have to launch into some larger reflection about games as ritualized conflict and the role of playing in rehearsing skills needed in actual conflict. You might even suggest that ritualized conflict reduces the need for actual conflict. The football pitch as a substitute for the battle pitch. I'm resting.
Okay. Should we go on? Catherine,
there is an internal logic of the system, the rules of football, but the meaning of the system lies elsewhere, and it can only be understood through some sense of the wider human context in which it is set. To do this, you have to step outside the system and see why it was brought into being. There is no way of understanding the meaning of football by merely knowing its rules. They tell you how to play the game, but not why people do so, and why they invest in it, the passions they do.
Keep going, the internal?
You want to keep going?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
The internal workings of a system do not explain the place the system holds in human lives. The meaning of the system lies outside the system. Therefore, the meaning of the universe lies outside the universe. That was the revolution of Aramaic monotheism.
Great.
Okay, what have you said? Abraham. The same is true for science, whose subject is interrelationship of things within the natural world. Nature is sublimely indifferent to who we are and what we deserve. There is nothing moral about it. It carries no meaning within it. Science tells us how the parts are related, but it cannot tell us what the totality means. Only something or someone outside the universe can give meaning to the universe. Only belief in a transcendental God can render human existence other than tragic. Individual lives, even within a tragically configured universe, may have meaning, but life as a whole does not.
So it's interesting. He says, if you study the rules of football, soccer, from today to tomorrow and understand every nuance of the game, you still won't have an answer to the question of why is it important? Why is it relevant? Why are people excited about it? What does it mean? Why? I understand how it works. I understand what happens in the game, but why? And he says this is true of any system. If you study any system, inside the system, all you're going to get are the mechanics of that system. If you want to understand, well, why is it relevant? Why is it important? What does it mean? In the larger context, you have to step out of the system and look at it from a different vantage point. He says, this is where religion and faith comes in. Science will tell you how things work and what things do. Faith and religion will tell you, Judaism will tell you, why it's all here in the first place. And for what purpose does it serve? And that's a completely different conversation. So science will not be able to tell you why you and I are here. In fact, a scientist might tell you that that's not even a valid question. Right? Richard Dawkins, who just passed away. Right? He published his final work. He says, there's no God. Right? That was his big declaration, final declaration. There's no God. Okay. Fine. If you ask him, why are we here? Not how did we get here. Not how did we get here. Different question. Why are we here? What might he say? I know he's not around to answer. What might he say?
He would have us read D.O. Wilson's The Meaning of Existence.
And what does it say there?
There is no God.
No, but, yeah, but why are we here?
Well, that whole book explains what Wilson
thinks. Okay, well, I don't know. I don't know what he would say. But he might say, you can't ask that question, why. Who says there's a why? Who says there has to be a why?
Why not?
Why?
We used to say you can't. We're here because we're
here.
Who? The guy who doesn't believe in God.
Listen, we're not proving anything here today. Yeah.
You asked the question.
Yeah.
He asked us, why are you guys here?
Yeah.
To prove you're wrong.
Or to prove you're wrong, right. Right. Oh, you're saying that's why he's here, to prove the religion. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think he would say, I don't know what he would say, but maybe one who doesn't believe would say that you can't. It's not a valid question to ask why. But human beings do ask why, and many of us want to have an answer to that question, and you can't answer that question inside the system. Example, I've used this many times, you probably heard me say it a bunch of times. If you walk into a kitchen and you see a pot of water boiling on the stove, and you ask the person in the kitchen, why is that water boiling on the stove? And they say, well, it's because there's water in a metal pot and it's being heated by the fire to the temperature of 212 degrees. And 212 degrees is the boiling point of water at sea level, and that's why the water is boiling. Have you answered the question?
Well,
you've answered the scientific question of why.
It's boiling because I'm going to make spaghetti.
And then the person is going to say, I know how it's boiling, and I know what makes it boil, but I want to know why it's boiling. You cannot look at the physics of the pot and the fire and the water to understand why it's boiling. How are you going to get that answer? Outside the pot. That's how you get the answer, by asking the person who put it up in the first place to boil, why did you boil it? I don't care about the mechanics of how it got to be boiled, or physically, chemically, or whatever, right? I want to know why. Is it? Are you making a soup? Are you making pasta? I need to know. I'm hungry, right? So that's, in order to understand the why of a system, you need to step outside the system. There's a wonderful text. A philosophical text, text 3 on page 151. You can read it after the class or right now, whatever it is. We're not going to read it inside, but it says the same thing. To understand the system, you have to step outside the system. So, and page 152 are wonderful quotable quotes that talks about how the answer to why or the meaning of life is a religious answer and it's not a scientific answer. The point of this is that science inherently is limited in its scope. And it's not a deficiency within science, it's just the parameters of what science does. Science explores the mechanics of that system that it's exploring. And it can't explore something outside the system because that's not what it's doing. It's exploring the parameters and the rules inside this system. If you want to understand this system in a larger context, well, then you need to step outside of that. And so here we have a dual, and here, so now we have place for these dual systems. We have the system of science that can tell you about the mechanics of the workings of our world and universe, and you have religion which tells you why all of this is here to begin with. Two different conversations. So, again, point number one, big idea number one is Torah needs science to be effective and accurate. Science needs Torah to answer all of the questions, even if science doesn't know it yet, but science cannot answer all the questions because some are outside of its own system. So Torah needs science, science needs Torah. This explains something else. This explains why the methodologies of science and religion differ so drastically. And this is big idea number two. Big idea number two is, why do the methodologies differ so much? The methodology of science is analysis, study, examination, exploration, critical thinking, scientific process, and religion, faith, and belief, and acceptance, right? Suspension of logic sometimes. Why? Why is it so different? Simple, we just answered the question, but let me put the pieces together. Science, which is about studying the inner workings of the system, has to make sense. If you want to understand the workings of a system, you have to logically understand it. If you're explaining the game of American football or world football, soccer, if you're explaining that to someone, you have to tell them the rules in a way that makes sense. It has to have logic and it has to make sense, or else they're going to be like, I still don't understand the game. Like, what's happening? American football, right? So why do they keep on running and stopping? And running and stopping and running and stopping? Why is it like interrupted? And why does sometimes that, the people with those color uniforms, why do they have the ball and sometimes the other people have the ball? And why in middle of nowhere sometimes are they kicking the ball between the things? How do they know what to do when? How do they know to suddenly stop or start? What's going on here? So take it easy. Let me explain. You're explaining this logically because you're explaining the rules of the system within the confines of the system. So anytime you're explaining something inside a system, so you're going to explain it logically. But religion, we just explained, is not about explaining the inner workings of a system. It's explaining the context, the larger context of why all of this exists in the first place. So in other words, religion, the way we're understanding it now, is to explain the why of the universe. It's not the what and the how of the universe. That's science. It's explaining the why of the universe. Again, I'm physically going to step out if this is the universe, right? So it's stepping out and saying, why is all of this here? Well, Judaism, for example, we'll speak about Judaism, believes that that information can only come from a higher source. How can you and I, how can you and I, inside the system, have a vantage point of understanding the context of the system that's outside the system? If we're inside the system, the best we can do is study the system. We can't be outside the system and in the system at the same time. To have a perspective, a larger context, perspective of outside the system, means that we're having information come in from outside the system. That means revelation, that means divine communication, and that this is what we talk about when we talk about faith and acceptance of Torah, of God's Word, etc. It means that inside the universe where we find ourselves locked in, we can only be scientists. We cannot explain why this is here. For that, we accept what we believe to be the Word of God. And that's something that's not logically proven because we can only prove what's inside the system. You cannot prove communication outside the system. It doesn't make sense. You with me on this? Sort of? So again, the methodologies are different because science, which is working inside the system, analyzes the system. But if you're trying to get a message from outside the system, so you accept it. And if you don't accept it, you don't accept it. But that's the way the system of faith, Torah, Judaism, religion works. Yeah.
So is that like Torah as therapist or God as a therapist? Because a therapist steps outside and looks at...
In a sense, yeah. You can say that. You can say that it's kind of like getting the bigger picture, but you can't, if you're inside the picture, you can't get that picture. You can analyze from the inside and break everything down and understand the best of your ability, but you're never going to see the full picture. That's a great example, unless you're on the outside. And if you're on the and when you hear something from the outside, you don't see it from that. So there's a certain measure of acceptance where you have to accept that that's the way it looks from the outside, because you're not seeing it. You with me on that? You can analyze and prove what you see in what you see inside. You can't do that from what you don't see on the outside.
Because it takes the emotion out of it to step outside.
Yeah. And we do this all the time. Yeah.
Before it came, I was early, so I was rereading the beginning. And 6A on page 14.
That might be way advanced.
Very beginning, but it kind of... This is from some atheist, and he explains... He's explaining how he can't really be. He says at the end, the challenge now is to explore what God, quality God has. I have proved that this God does exist by some reading all of this. He's proven it. It's kind of weird, but it kind of...
Are you saying one of the earlier lessons?
It fits right in.
Yeah. Like one of the earlier lessons, yeah. I remember that text, yeah. Good, yeah. You could say that, yeah. As far as a connection?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it would be... The goal of our first big idea is actually not to keep them divided, but to bring the two together. Mm-hmm. To say that Torah needs science. Torah is also analytical. Science... has an inherent weakness in that it can't explain logically everything. So it needs the explanations of religion, which are going to be a matter of faith, to explain all, to answer all of the questions. So I want to avoid moving them to different places. The goal here is to bring them together, to say how there's some sort of convergence between these two fields. Torah needs science needs Torah.
The text talks about science explaining creation, things within creation.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also talks about religion imbuing life with purpose and meaning.
Right.
And so, which is something different than the scientific method for using research and
correct.
Pure intellect and logic. But that doesn't mean those things can't coexist.
Correct. Yeah, and that's why the quotable quotes on page 152 are interesting, because you have Albert Einstein, who says, to know an answer to the question, what is the meaning of human life, means to be religious, and here you have somebody who's saying that there are only certain questions that can be answered through the scientific method. Some just cannot be. And it's not a deficiency, it's just a reality. And to answer that question, you need to draw on some other system, some other body of knowledge. Yeah. Yes.
But there's certainly no scientific explanation for that.
I've heard that there is.
Yeah, there is.
I've heard that there is a strong wind,
yeah.
Right? Special effects. By the way, as a rabbi, I'm totally cool with saying that it was a miracle, and that we can't explain it. That's another area of question. Look, we have this. There's the second half of this class is about answering the questions on the ground. So far, we've just dealt with methodology. When I started off talking about the divergence of science and religion, we talked about methodology and facts on the ground. So when it comes to methodology, the different methodologies make sense. Science is about logical inquiry, making sense of the system. Faith is about understanding, accepting a perspective that's outside the system. So one's inside, one's outside. They're allowed to be different. Yeah.
Maybe instead of using the term religion, if we use the term faith or belief, because when you think about religion, we often think about specific religions or the negative connotation
yeah.
of religion, a
right.
very rigid kind of system, whereas what you're talking about is kind of an overall belief.
Higher, exactly.
Higher,
well put. I only meant the positive, not the negative elements of it, yeah.
Science is continually evolving. For example, at one point we thought the world was flat, now we think it's not.
Wait, when did that change?
You say three dimensions were the thing.
Next thing you're going to tell me that the presence under my tree, yeah.
You say three dimensions were the thing, now we say four, through time. I know that science has discovered subatomic particles, which actually go backwards in time. But here's my question. Is there philosophically a point at which that man's science could advance to the point where we could actually explain God, and for that matter, contact God?
I doubt.
No.
Wow. Good question. So I have this new device that I just created. Joking. That's a great question. Hold the question, because I want to speak about some of these things in the second half of our lesson when we talk about facts on the ground. And you'll see some of that comes up in the context of that discussion. So actually, now let's do... Tom.
Since we're on the methodology, and I have great respect for
Rabbi Sacks, particularly his leadership of our Torahs on the various sections of Torah, on page 150, he says, only belief in a transcendental God renders human existence other than tragic. Does that include a Trinitarian transcendental God or only a monotheistic transcendental God?
That's a great question. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
I don't know what he means. Yeah.
Science and religion.
Right.
Should we say they're wrong because
the objective of this class is to break down some of the perceived barriers between these two fields.
Well, there's a big barrier there. They don't know what to believe.
Well, listen, people are people and people do their own thing, but we're talking about hopefully core truths, and that is Torah needs science. When people ask the Rebbe, I don't want to wade into the whole vaccination conversation because I know there could be a lot of emotions on it, but I will tell you...
Science and religion, that's all I'm pointing out.
No, I understand. Yeah, what I'm saying is, but you're asking a question about what some communities in Israel are doing, and I can't comment on what people are doing because that's a different conversation. What I can tell you, the objective of this class is to break down perceived barriers between the field of science and the field of religion, to say that Torah needs science. It needs science. It can't function without an accurate knowledge of science. It just can't accurately function. It can make up function. It can say that things are kosher when they're not, or things are not kosher when they are. It can make up. It can say that a Shabbos elevator is fine when it's not, or say that it's not fine when it is fine. It can make up engineering realities that aren't real on the ground, but it needs it. Jewish law needs act. If you want to say that the Jewish month begins on this day based on the astronomical realities, it probably makes sense to know the astronomy, to know the science behind it. So again, that's how Torah needs science, and science needs Torah as well. And that's why methodologies are different. Now let's move on to the second half of the class. Second half of the class is facts on the ground that are divergent. So fine, we understand why the scientific mind is all about careful analysis and careful examination and critical thinking, and why religion is often marked by belief in faith, because it's about something greater than what we can understand in the first place. Now that makes sense. We get it, and we can perhaps embrace it more. But we have realistic questions. And that is, what happens when Torah, which is, we just said, is speaking about the why. What happens when Torah speaks about the mechanics of the universe itself? What happens when Torah, which is supposed to be about context, starts speaking about the mechanics of the system and telling us how old this system is? And it's like, wait a second, you were fine when you were telling me I was here to make the world a better place. You were fine when you were telling me about, you know, being a good person and tikkun olam. That was wonderful. But now you're telling me how old this is, but I'm measuring it and it's measuring different. So you're telling me it's 5,779 years old, but I'm measuring it to be 16 billion years old. We have a problem, and I'm not going to call Houston for this one because I don't think even Houston is going to help me for this one. We have a major issue here. When Torah and the facts on the ground, when Torah and science are divergent. So I need to mention a few points. Point number one. This is really big idea number three, but here's the first point in our second part of the discussion. And that is that in general, science never speaks in terms of facts and truths. Science speaks in terms of theories and hypotheses. I'm not saying scientists. You can have a scientist that says, I know this to be a fact, and that's fine, because people can say anything. But science itself, science, never speaks in terms of proof or facts or truths. Science is about hypothesis and experiment and theory. Let me explain why I'm saying this. There is, and there has been for centuries, a trend amongst Jewish scholars, and even prominent Jewish scholars, when faced with these types of questions, the question of, well, how can Torah say this when science says this? There has been a trend for many centuries to engage in what we would call Jewish apologetics or Torah apologetics. And what that means is you take a verse or you take whatever it is, whatever source in Torah that doesn't seem to match up, and you contort it to fit the science of the day. You contort it to make it make sense. Oh, well, you know, the 24 hours of creation aren't really 24 hours, and therefore maybe each 24-hour day wasn't a day. Sorry, maybe each day of creation wasn't 24 hours. And if it's not 24 hours, well, maybe it's a billion years. Boom, now we have 7 billion years. We're good, right? So you take when Torah says, Vayihi Erev, Vayihi Boker, Yom Echad, it was evening, and it was morning. One day, you say, ah, it doesn't mean day, it means billion years. That's contorting Torah to fit the scientific narrative. And it's been done, Maimonides talks about it, and it's been done by very great scholars. There are two challenges, two issues, two problems with this. Number one, you're taking Torah out of its simple meaning and distorting it or contorting it. Number two, it's super awkward when science moves on, and this has happened many times, because science is not standing still. The science that we have today, in 2018, is vastly different than the scientific knowledge that they had 100 years ago, and so vastly different than what they had 200 years ago, and radically different, perhaps even indistinguishable from what they had 300, 400, 500 years ago. Correct? Correct. So imagine you're a scholar living Maimonides. All right? You're living in the 1100s, 1200s. Yeah, you're living 800 years ago. And now you contort Torah to fit what we would call today some sort of outdated scientific, you know, hogwash that they had then. But you've contorted. This is not about Rambam, by the way. This is not me. This is not about Maimonides. I'm just giving a name. But imagine if you were a scholar at that time and you contort Torah to fit science, and then science moves. So what are you doing? You're like, yeah, I like this. This is, when no one's watching, let me straighten back up again. Right? There's a movement, but one way of looking at this is, we always need to be careful in twisting Torah to fit the latest scientific theory, because number one, you're twisting Torah, and number two, what happens when science evolves? Then what? You're left holding the bag. So now what? What was the point? You just look silly that you don't have any values that you're holding on to. You're always making it match whatever's in vogue, and I mean that's not having an anchor. So that's not the approach that we're going to take in today's class. I could tell you to read Gerald Schroeder. I could tell you to read other books, and they'll tell you, oh my gosh, the way the universe expanded at the rate of acceleration, it aged the universe so fast in those few moments, right? With the expansion of the universe, and they show the formulas, and it's wonderful. And I'm not saying it's not correct, but I want to take a simpler approach today. It's a theory, and it matches a current theory in science. But again, everything's evolving. Science, if you could speak to science, whoever that is, or whatever that is, science will tell you. Its goal is to discover more, to disprove what it already knows, to find something greater. That's the goal of science, is to learn more, to evolve, and to expand. It's not to sit still. Okay. So the approach we're going to take today is science, modern science, when it measures the universe as being 16 or whatever it is, billion years old, that is correct. It's correct. And Torah and Judaism, when it says that God created the world 5,779 years ago, it's also correct. And I know what you're thinking. How can that be? It's like the story of the two people that go to the rabbi's house, and each one has a claim about the other one, and the rabbi says, the one you're right. The other says, well, he says, you're also right. And his wife, the rabbi's wife, says from the other room, how can they both be right? And he says, you're also right. You're also right. So Science, when it measures the world at 16 billion years old, is correct. It's correct. And Torah, when it says that God created the world 5,779 years ago, it's also correct. Shakespeare will give us the answer. Anybody familiar with King Lear? Yes, King Lear, yeah. So, what's the basic premise? He's an old king, a little foolish, gives away the kingdom to two of his daughters, one he doesn't, and then everyone conspires against him and he loses everything, right? It's a tragic story. Okay, you read the story of King Lear, and here you have this old king who's making foolish decisions, and you think to yourself, if you wanted to analyze him, what was his childhood like? Who were his parents? His wife, the queen, nothing. Right? Come up, can you analyze and come up with a backstory? Yes? Theoretically, can you analyze him and come up with a backstory of how he got here to where he is? Yeah. If you went to Shakespeare and you tell Shakespeare, I know who this person was in their youth, what would he say to you? He's like, dude, I just created him. Now, he's a new king with an old story.
Oh, that is cool.
He's a new king with an old story.
That's how you say both are correct.
So, the way it works is like this. Science operates, we're going to use another paradigm right now. Science operates within the rules of cause and effect. This is very important. Science believes at its core, and this is one of the fundamental rules of science, is the notion of cause and effect. If you have something in front of you, something else caused it to be. It came from somewhere else. And that came from somewhere else. And that came from somewhere else. And you can trace it back. And if you understand how it goes back, you can also understand how to roll it forward. Right? So if you understand how things evolved to how they got here in the current state, you can understand how they might continue to evolve and get to some sort of future state. Are you with me? The premise of science is, if this thing exists and operates and moves and functions and reacts in a certain way, it must be because of these other factors that cause it to do so. Cause and effect. And each effect, right, so this is the effect, there's a cause, and that cause is the effect of a previous cause extending back. And so when we look at, I'll give you a simple example. You look out and you see a star, and that star is so far away, it's a million light years away. It would take a million years to travel. That's how far it is, a million light years away. I don't know how long it would take for travel, forget travel. A million light years away. But its light is reaching the Earth. Which means that when that star came into being, for that light to reach the Earth took how many years, at least? That means that the universe must be at least a million years old, right? Right? It's logical, right? If you, again, simple logic. Forget about carbon dating, which is always awkward. So, you come here often? Yeah, all right. I will not do a carbon dating joke. Oh, wait, I just did. I didn't say carbon dating. That's like, bah, you hear often in the temple. Carbon is sacrifice in Hebrew. All right. Tough crowd. Right. Let's get quickly back to this point. Again, it's a very simple, science is, it's very straightforward. If there's a star that's a million light years away and its light reaches Earth, that means it must be in existence for at least a million years because it took a million years to reach it and it's here. So it must be that old. If King Lear is 60 years old in the play, he must be... Oh, wait. He doesn't have to be that old.
No, that's pretty young to us.
One second. If King Lear is 60 years old in the play, so how old must he be? When must he be created? By Shakespeare. Can Shakespeare create King Lear... At 60?
Yeah.
What about the previous 59 years? It's an implied history. It doesn't have to actually play out like that. Judaism believes that God created the world, not something from something which is cause and effect. Sorry, I forgot to make this connection before. Cause and effect means something from something. Every something has a previous something, and that has a previous something. Judaism believes famously, and many of you have taken courses where we've discussed this in Kabbalah, Judaism believes that the world has not created something from something, but rather something from nothing. It's not a small difference, it's a huge difference. The difference between Yesh Meyesh and Yesh Meyayin is massive. Something from something means that everything has an antecedent, and that has an antecedent, and that has an antecedent. You go back, 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 back. So if the light is here from that star, then it must, if you see light here, then you trace it back to that star, and that star is a million light years away, so it must be a million years old. That makes sense. Logical progression back, something from something. This light comes from there. But Torah says that God created the world, Yesh Meyayin, something from nothing. What does that mean, something from nothing? That means there's a certain point before time, outside of time, when everything begins and has no antecedent. And everything begins from this blank slate, not in an embryonic state, but in a fully developed state. Which means, and this is what I'd like to share with you today, this is the big idea. Big ideas 3 and 4, I'll tell you what 3 was soon. We already did 3. 3 is so 5 minutes ago. Big idea number 4 is God created a world. God created a King Lear type world. A world with an implied history. A world that already had a history as if it was cause and effect. As if it was something from something. But it's something from nothing. In other words, who's to say that God didn't create the star that's a million light years away together with its light already reaching planet Earth? Who said that stars need to begin in a state where they're baby stars just starting to blossom and share their light, and it actually takes a million light years for it to reach Earth? Who said that that's how it works? A cause and effect system, a something from something system that says you have to logically go back in that order and progression. But Judaism says that's not how it works. God created the world from nothing. There was nothing, and then suddenly there was everything. And everything means everything with a story. With a history. King Lear is created not as a baby. He's created as an adult with an implied story. So I'll ask you the following question. Can you tell me definitively that God didn't create a world that already has pre-embedded fossils? Or that has an age that by carbon dating looks to be 16 billion years old, or that has light shining from millions of light years away? Why not? Why not? Now you might ask the question, but why did he do that? Why didn't he create a world, an embryonic state? Well, why didn't Shakespeare write King Lear from when King Lear was a baby? You know why? Who would read that story? Well, unless Shakespeare wrote it, it'd probably be interesting, but Shakespeare had a purpose for writing King Lear. And that purpose began when King Lear is an adult, an older king. That's when the story begins, because that's when he decided the story should begin. What's to say that God... I'm not definitively saying anything. I'm just saying these two things aren't contradictory inherently. They don't have to be a contradiction. You can measure the world as being 16 billion years old, and that can be true. That can be an accurate measure. And you can also say that God created that aged world 5,779 years ago. It's not a contradiction. But wait, they're fossils. So what? Who put the fossils there? You know who put it there otherwise? You know somebody from back then? You're measuring it. Fine. So again, if you look at King Lear, it's like, well, Shakespeare must have written this 60 years ago. No, he didn't. He just wrote it now. You understand what I'm saying? Does this make sense? I'm not saying this is how it went down. I'm just saying you can't say that this is how it didn't go down, which means that there's no inherent contradiction between the two systems. You can't say, no. Science measures that it's billions of years old. Right. If that's how he made it, that's how you measure it, because you're working backwards. And when you work backwards, that's how long it stretches out. It's fine. Now, again, why didn't God create the world in its infancy? Why didn't God create Adam and Eve as babies? Right? Because he wanted them to get down to work. He didn't have time for them to grow up. Right? Get down to work. There's forbidden fruit you need to eat. I wink for those of you on this side. I'll wink. Right? We got to get down to work. Shakespeare has a point. He doesn't want to start off with King Lear's, childhood, learning how to crawl. That's not relevant. We got to get cracking here. So God creates a world ready to go. By the way, day 4, the Torah says, God created the sun, moon, and stars. Shining. They weren't like... Anyway, I hope this makes sense. The point is... By the way, this approach is called from many, many, many letters that the Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote to prominent scientists in the United States and abroad. Some of them are published in the back of this lesson. You can read the letters in their entirety. Where the Rebbe is very strong about saying, number one, evolution and everything, it's still a theory. And even if you have multiple, huh?
Oh, I was going to say, I thought that was a big mistake calling it a theory of evolution.
What else are you going to call it?
Well, I think there would have been a lot less controversy if they just called it evolution.
No, but they can't. You can't call something a fact. Scientists can do whatever they want because they're people. I can call something a fact also, but science can't call anything a fact, even if we almost know something to be so true that we will risk people's lives to send human beings into orbit in outer space based on our calculations. You still don't. Look, today we're surprised. What? Something can act. Light can be both a particle and a wave. We have no idea how that works. We have no idea how that works. And how the large perspective of science differs from the quantum state of science. There's so much more that we don't know than we know. So there's, as far as what we know as facts, we don't know anything as facts. We have theories, and theories we can operate on. But the point is not to debunk a theory. The point is to say that you can have a theory that works within one system, or that's true in the rules of this system. The rules of the system are you work backwards and you keep on going. So you keep on going backwards, 16 billion, evolution, no problem. But again, so one of the things is, I think it's dolphins that have hand-like bone structures in their fins, right? So it's like, so people evolved, or like that's a piece in the evolutionary thing. Could God have created that with that? Of course. So again, if you take this approach, you can reconcile both systems. Science is correct that's the age of the universe as we measure it, and the measurements can be perfectly accurate. This is not a challenge to the accuracy of carbon dating. This is not saying that our microscopes are not good enough or our chemistry is not good. This is not at all a criticism of the scientific method. It's saying you're measuring accurately. And God created that reality 5,779 years ago. God created an old world from new. Why not? Who's to say? So both are correct. This notion that, oh no, how can I embrace religion, faith, Judaism when science is so diametrically opposed? Take it easy. It's not so diametrically opposed. It's not a contradiction. This is but one way to explain it. You want to read Gerald Schroeder's Computations, read his book, Science of God. There's a lot of stuff out there. You can answer these questions many different ways. The point is today, as we stand in Lesson 5 of Wrestling with Faith, the point is to know this, that when we think of science as the arch enemy of faith, the arch enemy of Judaism, oh no, science teaches heretical things. Take it easy. Science teaches science. And Judaism teaches Judaism. And they're complementary. First half of the class, they're complementary. Both need both. And number two, they're not a contradiction. Even when it looks to be the biggest contradiction, it's not a contradiction. And I know we're only answering one question about age of the universe. This applies to other areas as well. And so, what are the four big ideas? We'll close this out. What are the four big ideas we spoke about today? Number one, big idea number one was... Torah needs science to function. Science needs Torah to provide meaning. Number two, big idea number two, science speaks to the what and how, and Torah speaks to the why. Number three, science speaks in terms of theory and hypothesis, not in fact and law. And number four, science operates within the rules of a something from something system, cause and effect, and Torah operates within the rules of a something from nothing system, and that changes everything. Because that can explain how you have an old world that is created more recently than old. One final point. The more we learn in science, the more unity we find in the universe. You know, one of the famous decorations of Torah, one of the famous, most famous perhaps Jewish prayer is the Shema. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. This concept of divine unity and unity of everything, unity within the universe. And for thousands of years, or maybe billions of years, whatever, however you measure, so scientists would say, no, there's diversity. Look at all the multiplicity, look at all the diversity. And even a few hundred years ago, when you had the chemical, periodic table, how many elements do you have? How many? Yeah, whatever. You have a lot of elements in the periodic table, and then we consolidate it into more and more and more and more, and now we're down to what? Matter and energy, wave and particle, neutrons and protons, and atoms. We're down to like single items that are at the core of everything. And I'm not saying that this is what you were saying. I think this is touching on what you were saying before. I'm not saying that science is necessarily going to find the God particle. Because at some point, I think there's a divide between the spiritual and the physical. But it's cool. I think it's cool how, as science evolves, you can see within science some of these foundational, beautiful teachings of Judaism and faith within science. These unifying forces where science talked about diversity and how everything is different. Now it's speaking in terms of unity, and I think that's very cool.
Think about the creation story in the first place. How closely it can align to science. You know, the first this and then this.
Well,
and it was the water and we started there. And then,
so you can say that the Torah's account of creation mirrors an evolutionary approach. There are many different... You can approach the reconciliation from many different positions. The main thing that I wanted to express today is if a person ever feels like, I don't know, science is like, how do I believe? How does Judaism, how does it make sense in a modern world with modern science? There are many ways to explain it, and it's not such a contradiction. And take a deep breath. Take a deep breath and know that everything will work out okay. Thank you very much for joining me today for lesson number 5 of Wrestling with Faith.
And didn't you say that it was the Bible was taken off literally anyway?